We Real Cool, the pool players, seven at the Golden Shovel. We Real Cool, we left school, we lure light, we strike straight, sing sin, we thin gin, we jazz June, we die soon.
The poetry of Gwendolyn Brooks. She calls herself a black first, a woman next, a poet last. Trudy Kirshner of the Dayton Journal Herald gave this description of Miss Brooks. She wears a simple tweed skirt, a lightweight jacket. The shoes are low-heeled and slightly scuffed. Not a trace of makeup mars the coffee-brown skin. A few whips of gray dart through the neat, closely cropped afro. Her only jewelry is a simple map of Africa on a chain. She might be anybody's aunt on her way to the supermarket or neighborhood drugstore, but she is Gwendolyn Brooks, poet laureate of the state of Illinois, member-elect of the National Institute of Arts and Letters, and the first black ever to be awarded the Pulitzer Prize. On May 4th, Gwendolyn Brooks was at Central State University to share some of her works. In this program, she will share with us her views on black life. But first, let's take a closer look at Gwendolyn Brooks.
Gwendolyn Brooks is a native of Chicago, Illinois, and is a graduate of Inglewood High School and the Wilson Junior College. She was cited for creative writing by the American Academy of Arts and Letters in 1946 and received two Guggenheim Fellowships for creative writing in 1946 and 1947. She has published five volumes of poetry and a novel and received the Pulitzer Prize for Poetry in 1950 for Annie Allen, A Ballad of Chicago Negro Life. In 1968, Miss Brooks was named Poet Laureate for the state of Illinois, succeeding the late Carl Sandburg. Miss Brooks is active on the lecture circuit and is involved in fulfilling many social and civic commitments, both nationally as well as in the greater metropolitan Chicago area. She is married to Henry Blakely and is the mother of two children, Nora and Henry.
Donnell Lee says, when you view Gwendolyn Brooks' work in the pre-1967 period, you see a poet, a black poet in the actual, though still actively searching for her own definition of blackness, on the roadway to becoming a conscious African poet, or better yet, a conscious African woman in America who chose poetry as her major craft. However, Gwendolyn Brooks describes her poetry prior to 1967 as work that was conditioned to the times and the people. In other words, poetry that leaped from the pages, bringing forth ideas, definitions, images, reflections, forms, colors, etc., that were molded over a distance of many years. Her poetry notebook started at the age of 11 as a result of and as a reaction to the American reality. And for black people, regardless of the level of their perception of the world, the American reality has always been a battle, a real alley fight.
Gwendolyn Brooks says, until 1967, my own blackness did not confront me with the shrill spelling of itself. I knew that I was what most people were calling a Negro. I called myself that, although always the word fell awkwardly on a poet's ear. Donnell Lee says, her major associations during this period of redefinition were the young and the black writing that was part of their makeup. She had firsthand witnessed a resurgence of what has been termed the Black Arts Movement. In every aspect of the creative act, young brothers and sisters began to call their own images, from drama to poetry, from fiction to nonfiction, from plastic arts to film, and so on. In every area of creativity, black poets cleaned house and carved their own statues into what they wanted themselves to be, regardless of who was watching, and with even less regard for what critics, white and black, said. She felt the deep void when Medgar Evers and Malcolm X left us. This is expressed very vividly in the two poems entitled Medgar Evers and Malcolm X. Donnell Lee goes on to say that The murder of Mark Clark and Fred Hampton and other blacks continued to raise questions in her mind. And the major questions were, what part do I play? Where do I fit in? What can I do? She reflects these questions during the interview when she is asked to comment on her role as an instrument of social change. Gwendolyn, what essential role do you see yourself having as an instrument of social change, and how do you use your work as a medium for such?
Well, that sounds very grand and requiring. I really don't get up in the morning saying, well, now what shall I do today to implement social change? I do have as a basic personal theme black unity. That is what I think I should be about so far as conscious aboutness is concerned. Now, when I sit down to write, which isn't as often as I suppose it should be, I don't say I'm going to write a poem that will spearhead some degree of social change. First of all, I'm excited by something that has happened or something that I've seen or read or heard. And I am a great note taker, so I take notes. And then later, when I do have time, well, I'll spread these notes out and get together some shabby little first draft. Then begins the revision. These days, the product is, I would say, a procession from my abiding interest in black people. So I believe that anything I do write will be in accordance with that theme I just mentioned. Now, this has not always been the truth about myself and my writing and my compulsions. When I was a little girl, and sooner or later you'll probably ask, when did I start writing? So I'll tell you now. I began writing when I was 7 years old. My mother says I began putting rhymes together then. And I think you could say that my writing life has been divided into three parts. The first stage was from 7 to 13, and I would call that my express yourself category, because I just thought I should express myself about anything in my environment. And in my environment, there were clouds and dandelions and friends and enemies and books and chocolate cake. So I wrote about such things as those. I also tried to write about a lot of things I knew nothing of: love, death, war. I had never read W.E.B. Du Bois and other people that I should have known something about. So you would not find any social consciousness, except that was innocent and spasmodic because of something awful that had happened to me or that I thought was awful. So I say this stage lasted from 7 to 13. At the age of 13, I went to Hyde Park High School in Chicago, and there I was exposed to prejudice on a pretty steady basis. This was chiefly a white high school when I went there, and I remember writing a poem called To the Hinderer, and that seemed to me to open my integration favoring stage, when I thought that if blacks, especially writers, implored whites long enough and strenuously enough to love them and help them, they would. And pretty soon everything would be like paradise in the country. And I believe that that could happen straight up till 1967. Before I get there, let me say that I did write a lot of poetry, not always, but often, that sounded like this: grant me that I am human, that I hurt, that I can cry, Not that I now ask alms in shame gone hollow. Admit me to our mutual estate. A sort of pleading, a sort of whining. Can't imagine myself writing a poem like that today. Well, in 67, I went to a black writers' conference at Fisk University and saw young people who seemed to have different ideas from mine. Remember, Margaret Danner, very good poet, was there too. And we just walked around the campus just with our eyes wide open because everything seemed to be different, sound different, look different. And the young people stood up straighter and were sassier than any I could remember meeting. So I was much inspired by this new spirit. And Baraka was there, Ron Milner was there. Ron Milner wasn't well known at that time. And Baraka was called the Roy Jones. When I left that conference and went home to Chicago, I found an invitation from Oscar Brown Jr., a famous entertainer. He had developed a show out of the talents of the Blackstone Rangers. This was a huge gang of some 5,000 or so youngsters who had guns and were using them in Chicago, and had they had upset the city mightily, and they were always in the headlines, and they stored their guns at the First Presbyterian Church in Chicago. Well, there were girls among them too, and they were called Rangerettes. Well, I had always had this yearning to do something to help the Blackstone Rangers. So I asked Oscar, after I'd seen his beautiful show, which was called Opportunity Please Knock, if there weren't some writers among the dancers and singers, and he said yes. So I decided I would start a workshop, writing workshop for them. And some of them came looking at me with a rather odd curiosity. But to this group came also people like Donnell Lee, Hakeem Adubuti, and Carolyn Rogers, and Johari Amini, Mike Cook, and Walter Bradford, who helped me get them together, get the Rangers together, because he was a teenage organizer, very good writer too. This group became just friends, because when they joined it, those people I just mentioned, it was no longer a workshop, because they told me straight off they were not going to write sonnets. They weren't going to let me teach them to write villanelles. This was European. They were going to write their own free verse. Any way that they wanted to write, they would. And they were of great help to me and changed my life entirely. And we used to go around to taverns and recite poetry. There was the Wall of Respect, which happened in 67. And I remember the great celebration down there. We were all reciting poetry out in the street. Those were really great days. And their motto was, Black poetry is poetry written by blacks, about blacks, two blacks, and that became my motto. And I had no sympathy with the controversy that sprang out of that idea, that motto of theirs, because when Jewish writers, say, like Isaac Bashevis Singer, write as Jews, about Jews, to Jews, there's never any excitement. Nobody is spanked for doing what seems perfectly natural. So I am in that stage now and expect to stay there.
Okay. As a result of working with the Blackstone Rangers, was it during that time or after that time you wrote your three poems about the Blackstone Rangers? I think the first one is The Leaders, And then you have another one, Endgame Girls, and you have the other one, As Seen by Discipline. Did you write those poems after or during the times you were conducting the workshops with them?
I began to write the poems when I knew them. And I should say that they were not part of the group that continued with me for several years. However, Walter Bradford, I commissioned to start a little workshop for them. I knew that he could do a better job than I could and elicit more faith than I could, because he was young, knew them, and had worked with some of them. So he did that, and that went on for about a year. And he had about 20 rangers. And some of them wrote some very interesting things.
Did they carry it to a point where they became, like, very productive and they established a momentum of writing poetry? Did it have a lasting impact on them?
The fact that I was interested in them had a lasting impact on them. And some of them kept in touch with me, came over for dinner. I remember Walter and I took them to see, several of them, to see the Battle of Algiers, which had a great effect on them. And but I can't claim any great results from that encounter, so at least so far as writing is concerned. I don't know of any of them that have continued to the extent that they would publish. But that is not the be-all and end-all of existence. I mean, becoming a writer, that is not my chief interest in life. I shall go on writing, I imagine, as long as I live, but my chief interest is in helping young black people.
You made a comment about black unity. Now, when you refer to black unity, how does this relate to the third world concept?
So far as I'm concerned, it doesn't relate. The third world concept has never been anything that excited me. I always felt that black people have got to nourish each other and extend each other and love each other. I'm not scared of that word that some people feel is maudlin. And I am interested in all people. I think all people are capable of beauty and progress, have great potential. But I am not in my first youth, and I don't feel that I have time enough allotted to me, whatever it may be. I just feel that I had better work in my own vicinity of influence, and that is the black area. And I think that if we don't help each other, absolutely nobody else will. The Indians, and I empathize with them, are interested in the Indians. I do not see them killing themselves to help blacks. The Appalachians are, I've never heard of any interest that they have in the black condition. And I don't need to mention Caucasians. The days of liberalness certainly seem to be over. There's a great deal of indifference and apathy so far as blacks are concerned. So it seems as though it's up to us. And look at what we're doing. We're off in this direction and that direction and the other direction. And we're very busy fighting each other and resenting each other and feeling that ourselves are inferior to other dispensations. So I think I will continue with my own decision to help blacks as much as I can.
Better not ask.
Gwendolyn Brooks uses her poetry as a vehicle of communication to transmit ideas that reflect events and circumstances of her times. She emphasizes explicitly the paramount importance of the unification of black people. However, to eliminate misunderstandings and discrepancies in the general semantics of black unity, first we should explain what black unity is in this particular case. Black unity is the coming together of black people on a universal level to meet the economic, political, and social needs for the overall improvement for the quality of life for blacks, thus enabling them to make ample contributions to the path of righteousness for all mankind. To state it briefly, Gwendolyn Brooks says, quoting here, "To forge a black synthesis, a black union, so tight that each black may be relied on to protect, enjoy, listen to, and warmly curry his fellows."
But your real color, I've never really seen. Talking trash. Tell me, black maybe. Oh, really, would you rather for me? Would you rather for me not to ask? Time is running out. You see, the time is running out. And your man's been set for ages and ages. Black maybe, it's time for you to wake up and come around.
Could you tell others how they could help blacks in their own given area? Say, for instance, how could a black teacher, help black children other than just teaching them in the classrooms? Because, of course, they're turned off by the systems. What would you offer them as far as advice?
Teachers, my. Now, those are people who can really make a difference. I would urge them to do something on the order of what I'm doing now. In Chicago, I have a club of high schoolers. These are people that I found on my block, 18 of them. So I organize them into a forum, and they meet with me. The idea is that they are to express themselves in any way they see fit, to be absolutely free. And they talk about drugs and sex and love and their teachers and their parents. They say anything that's on their minds. And I have to go back a bit to tell you why I organized this club. It's because of two things that happened in my life. One, I was, during Attica time, I was listening to television, looking at television. I saw a reporter speaking to one of the Attica prisoners. He was behind bars, a most gloomy sight it all was. And this reporter was asking him questions about how he felt about himself and his plight. And he said that if at a certain time in his life there had been just one person who had had any interest in him, had been willing to take some time with him to show him that he or she cared at all about his continued existence, he wouldn't be where he was. That impressed me very much. And One morning, a policeman knocked on our door about 8 o'clock in the morning and asked us if we knew the identity of the young fellow who had been found dead behind our garage. What a sight. I mean, what a way to begin your morning, because I can't say what a sight I did not go. Well, of course, he had been taken away by that time anyway. But anyhow, I hadn't known him, but some of the kids on the block said that he was someone who was hard to know, virtually a loner, always in trouble, sullen. So it seemed to me that if we had known him and had done something to indicate that he was one of us, that we did care about him on that block anyway, well, maybe he wouldn't be dead. Also felt guilty because I had heard shots in the night and hadn't called the police. Naturally, I wasn't going to go out there. And to tell you the truth, you do have to be kind of selective about your police calling, because you don't want to get an innocent person into trouble. At any rate, I wondered if, had I called, his life might have been saved. The guilt, the Attica interview, and this killing itself made me decide to start the forum. In addition to providing a forum for these kids to talk, I found out that there were other things I could do for them. I took them over to Hockey's Institute of Positive Education, which is a block and a half away from me. And he talked to them about how he had joined my group and about how he had been writing poetry, Think Black, Don't Cry, Scream, and so forth, and how he had gone to Africa. And he got out a map and kept talking about Africa and pointing to Africa. So finally, one girl, Georgette Smith, said, "The others aren't going to say anything because they're too polite. In fact, she looks very much like you." She does. Said, "But I am going to speak for all of them." She said, "I am sick and tired of hearing about Africa." Said, "Africa has got nothing to do with us." Said, "Not a one of us is ever going to Africa, and nothing from there is coming to us. So why don't you just stop talking about Africa?" So that gave me this quick idea that I'd have to send as many of them as I could to some African country so they could find out whether or not there was anything relevant over there. So I sent the first two last August to Ghana, and they stayed a week in Paris, a week in London. I think that they were perhaps overimpressed by the Grand Hotel in Paris, but they were delighted to get to Africa and look at all these black people. That's what seemed to impress them most. All these black people walking around as if they own the country, which they do. And they certainly found that there were no blacks swinging from trees. Not that that's not all right if blacks want to swing from trees. It is not a sign of inferiority.
Come on, let's do it now. Africans unite. Come on, let's do it now. Africans unite.
They came back and told the others what they had seen. We had a special meeting. And two more will go, not this summer, but next. I have to restuff my pocketbook. Probably to the same place, because that is my favorite African country of the three I've seen. I've been to Kenya and Tanzania, but Ghana seemed to me to be the blackest of the three. Of course, when I went to the other two, that was in 71, and those countries seemed to me to be much in the grip of the Asians, who had absolute contempt for anything black. And I could understand efforts toward loosing them from those countries.
Are you saying that Kenya and Tanzania impressed you in that way?
Yes.
Even in view of the things that are, you know, the socialist concept, or I think it's the self-help concept that's being talked about now.
Well, now, you have to remember, or at least I should have told you, that I have no authority on any of these countries. I walked into the country, just up and decided I wanted to go. I wasn't with any group. And I went into the bush in Tanzania and was welcomed by a very impressive black family that had just scooped out part of the bush for a home. Weren't supposed to, but they just decided it was their land and it was their country. They were going to have part of it. So I'm not an authority, I'm trying to say. I have a great admiration for what I know of Nyerere, but what I saw was the Asian influence very strong. They were the ones who were, when I walked into a store, and I did a lot of just walking around, going into this and that. When I walked into most of these places, there was an Asian, and not happy at all to have you coming in.
Did they actually show
yes, uh-huh. They were insulting, often in a cold, very clever way.
That makes me think about an article I read in National Geographic about Tanzania, and it was talking about a lot of Asians being sent to Tanzania to help build the country. And as a matter of fact, they probably could have that feeling because they feel that they helped it, that country, you know, be built up to the point that it's at now. Maybe they don't want black Americans to come over there and assume their, I would say, natural role. Of course, there are a lot of people who feel differently. But I guess they say, well, if they come over here, they're going to pose a threat to us. And they know that actually we belong there more, you know, more so than they do, even though they're what, third world people. But we have that color factor going for us. Blood, strong blood ties.
Well, put it simply, it's our homeland.
Right. Good. Yeah. Okay.
Ms. Brooks, one question. You spoke a minute ago, earlier, saying that one of the youth said that, you know, this thing about Africa, you know, the relevance of our trying to find out what the continent is all about, what the people are about there. Now that we've all seen and read Roots, do you think this would possibly dispel some of these feelings that may have been present among black youths?
Yes, I'm really obsessed with Roots and what I feel it is doing for our people. I think that the great impact is and will continue to be on the children. I have a daughter who teaches in Chicago, and she has noticed a great difference in her children's attitudes about Africa and themselves. She is one of the most committed and dedicated teachers I have ever met, and she, when her kids came to her this time, they came with the idea that they didn't want to be identified with Africa. They didn't want to be called Africans. They were Americans. But she began reading Roots to them as soon as the book came out. And they were most excited about the order and the dignity and the warmth and the real beauty of those relationships. And then they didn't want anybody to say that there was any mixture in their blood. So there have been many spirited discussions in her class, because they also saw the telefilm and were much impressed and angered, creatively angered.
If any, what particular significance does black art of the Harlem Renaissance have in common with black art of today?
Well, it seems to me that it was more of a protesting art when it dealt with ourselves. And now, I think I better go back to the late 60s. In the late 60s, there was a great impatience with protest, because that was pallid, that was stagnant, and there was more of an obsession with the idea that I expressed as a motto, that black literature is literature by, about, and scheduled toward black. And that eliminated the white listener. The white listener to whom protests had been lifted.
I think you mentioned the art, black art of the 1960s. What about the Harlem Renaissance? Do you see a relationship between those two particular arts? I guess I'll, you know, quote Frantz Fanon. He says, black artists are cultural stabilizers, bringing back old values and introducing new ones. So what I'm asking you here is that, do you see black artists of the 60s and of today showing, bringing back some of the Harlem Renaissance styles of writing, or are they bringing back something from that type of writing so that they can hold on to the values of the past through their types of writing?
No, I don't see any return to the values and manifestations of the Harlem Renaissance. Even the people who have veered from their force and fieriness in the late 60s, that they had in the late 60s, have not, it seems to me, returned to the Harlem Renaissance aesthetic, a word that always irritates me. What they're doing now, those veerers, is turning into themselves. I don't expect them to stay there for the reason that you just talked about, the advent of roots, which I do believe is going to make a great deal of difference in the writing that we'll be receiving from youngsters. And what's happening all over the African continent, I believe, is going to have strong influence on writing to come. But right now, we have a lot of very personal writing, with the writers going into themselves instead of going out of themselves and finding their brothers and sisters outdoors there, which is what they did in the first fiery creativity of people like Haki, Sonia Sanchez, early Nikki Giovanni, and Etheridge Knight, and Mari Evans. Those were people who turned black poetry around. I thought it was going to stay around, but not that I mean that I want poetry from here to the end of time to sound exactly like the product of those people. Of course, we would progress and do something a little different here and something a little different there. But I had thought that the warm feelings for each other that we had and that were evidenced in those writings of the people I just named would remain. It's something we did wrong. We should have worked in such a way that our values would have come forth clean and powerful to the young people of today. And now if you ask them about Malcolm X, a lot of them have never even heard of Malcolm X. they've heard of Martin Luther King, because he's still in the headlines. But I had to play Message to the Grassroots for my kids. And they listened. It was new to them.
Steve, if you think there's an interrelationship between poetry, jazz, and blues.
Well, people like Haki and Baraka have invested music into their writing with exciting effects. I mean, if you look in the writing, you will see music. Not the notes, but... but I'm not capable of doing any such thing. I listen to music, I'm excited by it, but I really don't know about it as history.
Could you read some of your works for us?
Recite one poem that I know from memory. We Real Cool, the Pool Players, Seven at the Golden Shovel. We real cool, we left school, we lurk light, we strike straight, we sing sin, we thin gin, we jazz June, we die soon. This poem is called The Mother, and it's about abortions, of which I have had none. I always say that. Because for some reason people think that because I've written this poem, I must have had the experience. I guess that's a tribute to the authoritativeness of the poem, authoritative sound of the poem. But I have known women who have had abortions, and they have talked with me. Not all of them have felt as this woman felt, but some of them have felt. So, abortions will not let you forget. You remember the children you got that you did not get. The damn small pulps with a little or with no hair. The singers and workers that never handled the air. You will never neglect or beat them or silence or buy with a sweet. You will never wind up the sucking thumb or scuttle off ghosts that come. You will never leave them controlling your luscious sigh, return for a snack of them with gobbling mother eye. I have heard in the voices of the wind the voices of my dim killed children. I have contracted, I have eased my dim dears at the breast they could never suck. I have said sweets if I sinned, if I seized your luck and your lives from your unfinished reach. If I stole your births and your names, your straight baby tears and your games, your stilted or lovely loves, your tumults, your marriages, aches, and your deaths. If I poison the beginnings of your breaths, believe that even in my deliberateness I was not deliberate, though why should I whine? Whine that the crime was other than mine. Since anyhow you are dead, or rather, or instead, you were never made, but that too I am afraid is faulty. What shall I say? How is the truth to be said? You were born, you had body, you died. It is just that you never giggled or planned or cried. Believe me, I loved you all. Believe me, I knew you, though faintly, and I loved you all. If that last part sounds familiar, just remember that that poem appeared in my first book, which came out way back in 45. It's been quoted recently on the Diana Ross show. My daughter told me that she heard this in a little tribute to black women singers at the end of her program, and she was amazed to see no credits there, and I was amazed to get no part of that $1 million.
Thank you so much, Ms. Brooks. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You have been listening to a program on the life and works of Gwendolyn Brooks. Everything in this universe has a significant role. You have heard briefly about the significant role Miss Brooks is contributing to all of us.
This program was produced by Cheryl Brown and William Miller for WISO's Public Affairs. Special thanks goes out to Gwendolyn Lewis of Central State University, a very valuable contact, and of course, to Miss Brooks herself.
Peace is a united effort for coordinated control. Peace is the will of the people and the will of the land. With peace, we can move ahead together. We want you to join us this evening in this universal prayer. This universal prayer for peace for every man. All you got to do is clap your hands. One, two, three. One, two, three. One, two, three. One, two,